Open to our meeting. 9 a.m. on October 21st, 2025, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Moorish County PUD Board of Commissioners. Good Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today virtually is Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President. In person is Commissioner Juliette Altamola Crosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Operating and Legal Officer, Allison Mortensman, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltz, our Deputy Clerk. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. So I will start out with a flag salute, and you may go mute the flag.
People sleep.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the public agenda?
This is Commissioner Olson. Is my audio coming through?
It is. Good morning.
All right. There is an addition. Add item 03B. 0.01 at places, amended presentation, Edmund Sanitary Sewer Easement.
Okay, thank you. Comments from the public is item one on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and person shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located on the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial *9 if by phone. I'll call on you to speak at the appropriate time. When you call in on a phone, you will need to dial *6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, and indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents for other materials to enter into the record, hand them to the deputy clerk. We'll distribute them to the board, please. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So our first item is comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? Please state your first and last name for the record. We have Mr. Keeler. Good morning, Mr. Keeler.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Keeler, K-E-E-L-E-R. I'm a resident of Edmonds and a residential customer. I'm speaking to you regarding the cost of service analysis presented on September 9. The simple message is this: if my understanding is correct, the proposed rate increases I see are unacceptable. There's no wiggle room. Those numbers are acceptable. Now, you can't imagine me, commissioners, as one irate residential customer speaking to you, or you can consider yourself across the hall in the auditorium, an auditorium filled with angry residential customers. I don't think the commission understands the storm that may be coming. I hope I am wrong, but the proposed rates, and I see on the chart, you've got a copy, at the bottom it says it's preliminary. I understand. I hope that it is preliminary, but I tell you now, those proposals are unacceptable. It's wrong for me to stand here and criticize without offering a solution. I have two. I won't go into detail today, but I will tell you the PUD has to start cutting costs, reducing expenses, and the PUD has to identify new revenue streams. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Keeler. Are there any comments online? See no hands raised. Anyone else in the room? I see no hands raised. Okay. Next is item two, our consent agenda. 2A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of October 6, 2025. 2B, bid awards, professional service contracts, and amendments. 2C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? Please raise your hand. To the room or online. Any questions, commissioners?
I have no questions.
Commissioner Olson, okay. I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Next, item three, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This is an item for the board and general manager to discuss issues among ourselves with duty staff. So, good morning, Dr. Harlow.
Good morning, commissioners. Got a few items on the agenda today, and we're going to start with the Edmonds Stormwater Easement and Jennifer Southern. Morning, Jennifer.
Morning. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Southern, the lead agent in the real estate department, and I'm here to discuss the Edmonds Sanitary Sewer Easement. The purpose of this presentation is to inform the board of an upcoming request to declare surplus a portion of the district fee-owned land in Edmonds and allow the sale of an easement to the Edmonds Village LLC, located at 7212 220th Street Southwest in Edmonds. To answer any questions regarding the transaction, this easement document will be brought, excuse me, with the commission for a public hearing and vote by resolution at the November 4th, 2025 commission meeting. A little background, Edmonds Village is in the process of redeveloping a 4.22-acre business center into residential area adjacent to the district fee-owned Pacific Northwest Traction Company, the PNT, right-of-way, and the Interurban Trail. The sanitary sewer easement is needed to make the service connections to the City of Edmonds sewer mainline, which is already located on the district. The closed pipe will convey sanitary sewer to the City of Edmonds mainline, and again, that's already in existence. At the top of the screen here, you can see where the sanitary sewer easements are, the north and the south portions of the property, relatively small. The sewer easement itself is proposed of two areas, 10 by 35, and consists of about 700 square feet total. An in-house appraisal was completed by the staff, which determined the value was $9,800 for both easements. Once construction is complete, the City of Edmonds will take responsibility of the sanitary sewer easements as needed, the sewer pipes as needed, sorry. The next steps, no district equipment or facilities or access will be impacted. District staff have reviewed and approved the request. Additionally, we will be fully indemnified and bear no liability in the maintenance of the equipment. November 4th, 2025, Commission will hold a public hearing and vote on the resolution. And I'm here for any questions.
Questions, Commissioner?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the liability because it was my question that what specific responsibilities for maintenance or liability once the easement is when this is done. So thank you.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it.
Commissioner Olson, do you have any questions?
No questions.
I just have a general question. So when a city widens a road, we have to pay to move our lines if they're in the way. Is that similar for a sewer easement if some construction happens there, it's their responsibility to move those if that's required?
The sewer easement is going from private property onto the trail, okay. The connection of the trail. So the customer needs to pay for it.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Jennifer. Next up is our 2026 local forecast and Felician King.
Morning. My name is Felician A. I'm an economist in the rates department, and I'm here to share with you our 2026 load forecast. The purpose of this presentation today is just to update the board on the latest long-term load forecast. There's no expectations from this, it's just informational. So before we go into the forecast itself, I thought it would be a good idea to quickly go over our load forecasting process so that we're all on the same page. So beginning with our residential forecasts, we always start with our last year's weather normalized load. And from there, we try to predict the number of new premises that we think are going to come on. And this is a model that takes on population and residential permits outlook, which we get those from the Puget Sound Economic Forecaster. And that's a publication that's maintained by the Western Washington University. Within the same model, we take into account the type of premise and the type of heat. And then we add on our AV forecast on top of that, which is largely based on population growth and the assumption that the transition to EV will be gradual and peaking in 2025. We also make a few electrification assumptions, which one of them is that 30% of our non-electric homes will be converting over the next 20 years or so, and that about 85% of our homes will have some sort of air conditioning by 2040. We also take into consideration rooftop solar, which help offset some of our residential load. For the commercial forecast, we also begin with our last year's weather normalized load. We then again predict a number of new premises, but that model takes on employment and retail sales outlook instead. And then we have things like indoor ag or any discrete new load that are identified by our QCAMS team. For the industrial forecast, it's pretty straightforward. We start with our Schedule 36 customers' expected base load, and then from there we make any adjustment based on new information we hear from QCAMS team again. Once we have all that, we apply our energy efficiency, our codes and standard, and climate change impacts. And then the forecast is then passed on and incorporated into our budget process, our cost of service process. It also helps inform our IRP and any system planning efforts as well. So moving into our residential environment, starting with population, the current Snohomish County population is about 880,000 people. Last year, we saw a population growth of around 6,700, which is pretty similar to what we saw back in 2023. So we did notice a bit of a slowdown in growth over the last 2 years, and that was mostly due to migration. We saw a slower amount of people coming into the county, about 3,000 per year versus our usual 6,000 to 8,000. But overall, we are expecting our historical trend to recover over time, and we're still projecting the county to reach about 1.2 million people by 2045. Looking at our current housing environment, a chart on the left here shows our historical new connections by year. And as you can see, over the last 5 years, so between 2020 and 2024, the number of new connections have ranged between 4,500 and 5,500 per year. Premise growth did not slow down in 2020 or 2021 when we were experiencing COVID and very, very high unemployment. And even in 2022 and on, we still average above 4,000 new premises per year. And that's when we were going through peak inflation and above 6% mortgage rates. The chart on the right here shows the Snohomish County Housing Report for the month of September. And if you look at the sales activity column, you'll see that most of the homes here are labeled as either strong, very strong, or healthy, meaning that most homes will go pending within the first 30 days of listing. I'll say that the market isn't as hot as it was last year around this time, but the data is still showing that there's still quite a bit of demand in our area. So going into our residential new premise forecast, on the chart here, you'll see our current forecast in the blue line, and the dotted gray line is our last year's forecast. As I mentioned earlier, this model is based on population and housing permits forecast, and we've actually seen a slight increase in those two over last year's prediction. But overall, we are still forecasting within the same range between 4,500 and 5,500 new premises per year, which is on par with what we've seen in the last couple of years.
Are we forecasting a change in mix of housing types? It seems mostly that we're building apartments now.
We've made that change about, I would say, like a year or two ago, because we started to see more multi-family homes over single-family homes. So we actually started moving towards that trend already. So this forecast, you know, it's within that. This is a number, total number of homes in total, but within that, we do ourselves the number of multi-family homes.
This Commissioner Olson, excuse me, but that was a question I had, and I'm not quite sure if I correctly heard your response. Premises is a meter, or premises is the living unit, what you live in, like multifamily.
Premise will be a unit.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, I kind of have the same question. When you say the premises based on population, what do you mean with that?
So the model considers that if this population growth, there's a good chance that we would need more homes, more premises in the county to house these people. So it's correlated.
But you include every single household? Or every single home?
Yes.
So population means all every single home in Snohomish County and Cameron Island in order to do this premise.
Yes, for everything that's included in our service
target. Okay. Thank you.
So do you have an idea roughly what percentage of either multifamily let's say, you know, 5,000? If we're estimating 5,000, is that?
Yes, I think we've gone to, because of the new codes that have changed. Oh, wait, sorry, I'm talking about something else. I would say about 70% is going. We started to see that switch over.
Thank you.
Okay. Next chart. So a quick update on our electric vehicle. So right now in the county, we have just under 28,000 EVs registered. So far in 2028, we saw about 4,300 new EVs registered, and we are forecasting about another 5,000 or so to come on by the end of the year. For our long-term EV forecast, our assumptions there haven't changed, so we're still estimated about 700,000 EVs to be on the road by the 2040s timeframe. I do want to mention that we are on the lookout for any policy changes. As you may know, the state of Washington adopted California's vehicle emission standard back in 2022, which stated that new vehicle sales should be emission-free by 2025. So that mandate has been challenged earlier this year. So we are monitoring the outcomes of that, and that's including our adoption rates for EV and so the timeline of our forecasts. So putting it all together, we have our residential forecast in total here. The solid blue line is our historical load. The dashed blue line is our forecast, and right behind it is the dotted gray line, our previous year's forecast. So overall, we are looking at a slight decrease over what we were showing last year, just under 1% on average. The new premise forecast is helping bring that up, but that is offset by update to our conservation target, which is a bit more aggressive than what we had last year. So that is bringing our overall residential forecast down. For the EV forecast and electrification there, we haven't changed our assumptions, so it was just minor adjustments there.
So my unscientific conclusion is that the slope going forward is increasing dramatically compared to where we've been all the way back into the late 70s. So I want to understand, is this forecast like a P50 forecast where you have a 50% chance of it being above it or below it, or is this like a P90, or how do I put this in context?
So for the long-term forecast, we always forecast based on what we know best right now, and that's what we consider our expected forecast. The slope on the residential forecast line here is largely driven by electric vehicles, and that is something we've, you know, once we introduced that forecast years back, it was a concern, and it has been brought up with the system planning folks where, you know, they're planning towards that line. I would say that in the last couple of years, growth in EVs have been pretty significant. Year over year, we're looking at 30 to 40% growth. And I don't know if that trend is going to slow down.
I have a question.
This is Commissioner Olson. Am I interrupting anybody? It's hard to tell. With the EVs, given the potential for a slowdown due to federal regulations or pressure on the auto industry, does this take any of that into consideration, or is this something that we would take into consideration later, you know, in future years?
So right now we're continuing to be on the lookout for any new information that may come out.
Okay.
Cases. So once we have more definitive results, I think we'll make an adjustment to our.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, of course.
Okay, so I'm just curious, how often do you present the forecast to the board?
So to the board is an annual update.
Okay.
However, this is internally, we do update our forecasts on a monthly basis, especially before. As I mentioned before, our forecast is based on weather normal. And once we do have a weather update once a month, we make changes to that and adjust the forecast.
And how does this forecast compare to previous years in terms of accuracy and growth?
So if we normalize our actuals, I'll say in total, we were looking at about 4% on average errors.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, so moving on to our commercial environments, with our labor market, the Snohomish County unemployment rate was at 4.6% in August. And that is following pretty closely to what we're seeing at the state level as well as the national level. Around last year, at this time, the unemployment rates for the county was at 4.2%. So it has remained pretty stable through 2024 and into 2025. It's just a slight uptick. The couple of areas where we see a lower job count is in the aerospace industry, retail trade, leisure, and hospitality. As far as what we can expect into the future, here's a chart showing the Snohomish County unemployment rate historically in the solid blue bars, and the dashed bars is the forecasted unemployment rate. So economists in our region are expecting unemployment to remain relatively stable and settling in the 4 to 4.5% range over the next 10 years. So here's a look at our commercial new business forecasts. In this chart here, you'll see the actual in the gray line, the blue line is our forecast, and the dotted gray line is our last year's forecast. So the inputs to this model are employment and retail sales forecasts, which have remained actually pretty consistent as what we were seeing last year. However, we do want to consider some of the economic uncertainties. So far right now, employment has been relatively stable and consumer spending has been holding up, but we are starting to see some slowdown in those areas. We also have to consider the fact that some of these economic indicators may be lagging behind. And on top of that, with ongoing tariff discussions and the governor shutdown, there is possibly to introduce some instability, and that may show up in these numbers later on. But what we do know right now is that consumer confidence is trending down, meaning that people are feeling less positive about the economy in general. And when consumer confidence drops, that usually leads to less consumer spending. And that's an important point for us because recent employment growth in our region has been in the accommodation, food service, entertainment, and recreation sectors. And those would be the industry that would be most affected if consumers start to cut back. So for those reasons, we are making a short-term downward adjustment to our commercial new premise forecast to reflect uncertainties.
So does that reflect businesses that are, buildings are just empty, commercial spaces that are not being used? Is that, how is the economy getting worse?
So if I were to be a business and considering to maybe open another store, maybe twice before that, because if I see consumer, it's getting less. Okay, so the next thing that goes into our commercial forecast are discrete loads. Discrete loads are identified by our key accounts team, but only included into the forecast when there's credible certainty. And estimates are always reflecting the best information at time. So for this year, we are adding a couple of things, a 3-megawatt load for an indoor ag that's supposed to come on over the next 3 years, another 4.5-megawatt of load for an aerospace facility, also is coming on over the next 3 years. Things that we unfortunately had to remove from the forecast due to the projects being put on hold indefinitely is a timber facility, which was supposed to be 4 megawatt by 2028, and a fish processing facility, which was 6 megawatt by 2026. So looking at our commercial forecast in total here, again, we are looking at a slight decrease over last year's forecast, about 1% on average. So the things that are bringing our forecast down, like we mentioned, is the new premise forecast adjustment. Our conservation targets, again, are higher than last year's. And also the couple of projects that we have to move from the forecast offset by the new ones. Okay, so moving on to our industrial forecasts. Two major updates here, Boeing and Providence. For Boeing, we are continuing to push out the load that we've originally forecasted for the 737 MAX 10 production line at the Everett facility. As Boeing is still waiting for certification from the FAA, Boeing has mentioned that they expect that to happen in early 2026. The FAA currently still has the 737 production line capped at 38 planes a month, but Boeing is hoping to get approval to increase that to 42 a month. As for Providence, the hospitals are implementing some energy efficiency projects, and they anticipate their load to reduce by 3 to 5%. So we have reflected that in our forecast as well.
Yes.
I have a question. So regarding Boeing, the delay is only because we're waiting for the certification or something more?
Yeah, because it's the MAX 10, they don't have certification for approval for that yet. So looking at the industrial forecast in total, again, we're looking at about 1.5% decrease over last year's forecast on average. And again, the reasons for that is for Boeing, we're just pushing the load out, but the energy efficiency project from the hospitals and our own conservation targets are the two items bringing our forecast down. So putting everything together, we have our forecast in total. In the solid blue colors, you'll see that residential, commercial, and industrial historical load. In the dotted blue colors is our forecast for each of the sectors. The dotted green line is our last year's forecast, and a dashed green line is what our forecast would look like if conservation wasn't included. So as you can see, that is pretty significant. But overall, we are looking at about 1 to 1.5% on average decrease versus what we were showing this year. Okay, this last one here summarizes the driving factors that are impacting our load forecast. So the way to read this chart is anything above the zero axis line is an increase to our forecast. Anything below that is a decrease. And as you can see, the couple of items that are driving a forecast up is population growth, commercial industrial growth, and of course, electric vehicles. Things that are taking our forecast down is energy efficiency, closing standard, climate change, and a little bit coming from rooftop solar as well. But on the net, as you can see from the line going across the chart, we are expecting our forecast to grow. And that's all I had.
I have no questions.
Can you go back to slide 20? And John, this may be a question for you as much. I'm trying to understand what this forecast drives, getting to our customers' concerns about rate increases. How much is this driving the capital spend they'll be doing the next years, next few years, and how much of that is money that will be funded by customers if large load customers come in? Can you speak to that a little bit? I'm concerned about the trend not matching the history. And I understand why. And I know how hard it is to forecast. I spent a lot of time forecasting for a living. But can you talk about what this drives, what this forecast drives?
Yeah, it does drive our preparation to build out our system to make sure we can meet new customer and load growth. EVs would be probably the one of the bigger drivers that would be on us to have to build out the system. If we have a large customer, they bear a lot of the burden, the new construction costs, new capital costs, and investment in infrastructure. This doesn't really build in or capture any significant, you know, data centers or large load growth that would be built into our capital budget.
I have a question. Are we considering different scenarios, like, for example, weather or temperature or something that might impact all these forecasting that you present?
Yeah, so in our RFP process, we do have a high scenario and a low scenario that we work. But for a budget process and everything else, cost of service, we do use our base forecast that we call this here, which is considered expected forecast.
Thanks. Thank you.
Commissioner Logan, I do have one other question.
Yes.
Has any consideration been given, or is it too early in the pipeline for existing customers that want to convert from gas to electric?
So we have an assumption in our residential forecast that about 30% of our current non-electric homes will be converted.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I would guess we probably have some air conditioning assumptions to be increasing.
We are assuming, based on the trend that we are seeing, that by 2040, we'll have about 85% of our homes will have air conditioning.
Thank you. Any other questions, commissioners? Thank you.
All right, next up is the continuation of the 2025 Integrated Resource Plan, and Chris Guthrie. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Chris Scudder. I'm in the Power Supply Department. With me, I have Landon Snyder, who also worked on this presentation. So we're here to bring you a draft release of the 2025 IRP. What we're going to be going over today is taking a look at the draft IRP, giving you an overview, kind of how to navigate the document and what's in it. We'll take a look at the CEIP that's also available in draft form, and then we'll kind of talk next steps and how we get to the end of the year. Today is informational. There's no decisions needed. However, we are getting very close to needing some decisions on those IRPs. So getting to those at the end of the year. First off, I kind of want to go over the end of the year timeline. We've been working on this IRP for the better part of 24 months at this point. It's been about 18 months worth of work. And these are the last 3 months as we get to the end of 2025. We released our draft IRP on October 13th, so last week. We're here today on the 21st, talking to you, going over the draft. We started our SNEPA, the 30-day comment period, back on the 13th, so that'll go through November 12th. Where we take comments from the public in written form. We're going to take any feedback we get and then incorporate that over two-week-ish period at the end of November. And then we're going to come back to you on the 2nd of December with a final presentation of the IRP. That'll start our formal public hearing. And then we're going to have resolutions to adopt the IRP, CEIP, and biennial conservation targets on December 16th. That kind of gets us to the end of the year. As I mentioned, this has been a long process. It's been, you know, 18 months of a lot of work from a lot of different departments at the utility. And I really need to draw out some thank yous before we move on. First off, commissioners, thank you for your feedback over the last 18 months or so. It's been really valuable to hear from you and get and incorporate your feedback. ELT has been invaluable as well, getting our leadership feedback from our managers and our leadership. We have a tech team of 56, I think, ish employees here at the district, covering all manner of subject matter experts. So across several divisions at the PUD, we couldn't have done it without them. The public outreach we've done has been invaluable. We've talked to our public at 4 different open houses, a community forum, a community leaders forum, and informal and formal conversations. So that's been really, really invaluable. And then finally, the last thing I want to, last team I want to touch on is FORCOM. They've been able to get us a lot of outreach. They produced the one-page flyer that you, I believe, have. Sorry, Commissioner Olson, you don't get the physical version, but it is in the packet. They produced that. So this is kind of a one-page summary. I want to say the Cliff Notes version of the IRP. So it's available for anybody to take. It is also published on our website. To give feedback to us, if you are the public and want to get feedback on the IRP, you can, I'll give you the website here at the end, but it has this, the documents, and a way to get feedback.
Thank you. It's in Spanish, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's the other team. The CSRs did the translation for us. So couldn't have done it without them. Just kind of how to navigate the IRP. This is what it's going to look like. We have a 7-section main document, executive summary, who we are, planning environment, scenarios and planning assumptions, analytical framework, portfolio results, and key insights. And I'm going to talk briefly at a high level of what these sections are and what's in them. If you think of a topic that you want to know where it is, let me know and I can kind of point you to in the right direction. But this is how the document is laid out. Again, I got a shout out FORCOM for the cover. Wendy Paris did that work for us. In the executive summary, this is primarily a shortened version of the important items in the 2025 IRP. We have our progress on our 2023 action items, right? It's been about 2 years. We've made some progress on that set of actions. So talking about where we were in 23 and how we've gotten to where we are today. The key findings of this 2025 IRP, and then a long-term resource strategy and action plan summary. These aren't the full versions, but they are the kind of high-level summaries. Section 2 is who we are. This talks about us as a company. It talks about us, our historic trends, where we've been. So this incorporates a lot of the previous load forecast. And it talks about our existing portfolio of resources, so our Jacksons and our Young's Creeks, and then also our contracted resources. Section 3, the planning environment. So I'm going to go do these slightly out of order, but this is where we find a discussion of BPA and BPA policies. The policy and operating environment is going to look at different policies we adhere to and the various initiatives in flux around power planning, and then some regional initiatives that we talk about in here, RAP, organized markets, all that kind of information that sets up the environment that we're planning in, that's all in section three. The last thing I want to touch on is the strategic priorities, and that is our PUD strategic plan. We have a discussion in there of how the IRP impacts and supports the strategic initiatives that we here at the district are carrying forward. Section four is our scenarios and planning assumptions. We brought these to you way back in phase one. We talked about the different scenarios that we are going through and the sensitivities we're looking at. Here we have our load forecast and the planning assumptions that we make as we go forward through the resource plan. Section five is the analytical framework. So this is sort of the black box, I guess, or the box that the IRP is doing. So it's looking at how we developed our optimization framework. In here, you'll find a discussion of the various resource options that were considered, both demand and supply side. We also have a discussion of tier two resources here. Commissioner Logan, to your question two or three meetings ago, we have a detailed description of tier two to the best of our knowledge here in that section. There's a typo here that's supposed to be section seven is key insights and action plan. Section six is the results of each of those scenarios. So if you want to know the results of any specific scenario or sensitivity, that's six. Seven is the key insights and action plans. Here you'll find the key findings, the big sort of overarching findings of the IRP. We talk about the risks and opportunities the PUD could face over the planning horizon. Near, intermediate, and long-term resource strategies. This is going to be a 4, 10, and 20-year look out in terms of our resource strategy, which is a result of our analysis through those scenarios. And then finally is the 2025 action plan that we brought to you last time we were up here, which is those 16, I think, actions that staff will take over the planning horizon. We also have some appendices here. These are in the back. Appendix A and B are snapshots, summaries of the Clean Energy Action Plan and Clean Energy Implementation Plan as required by CETA. Clean Energy Action Plan is that 10-year look of demand response, conservation, and new energy resources. Clean Energy Implementation Plan, that's a 4-year kind of early snapshot. And we'll talk about the CEIP here in just a second. Appendix C, we talk about our public process. We did a bigger public process than we ever have in this IRP. And we talk about the results there and what we heard from our customers. Appendix D is the regulatory crosswalk. Currently, that is not populated. That'll be populated in the final. That's mainly for audit support and pointing to the document of where different statutes apply. Appendix E, demand response value. This has changed in 2025. Washington State passed a new law that gave demand response regulatory value. So we did an analysis there about where the value for demand response is falling. And that is in that Appendix E. And then Appendix F is emerging technologies. This is a longstanding appendix we've had in past IRPs. We take a look out in the world and we look at technologies that maybe aren't commercially available, aren't quite ready, they aren't quite fully developed yet, or we don't have good pricing data for them. And we will put them in here. They are technologies that we're monitoring, but we didn't feel that they were quite ready to be included in a resource strategy. Any questions on the IRP overview?
Commissioner Olson, do you have any questions this time?
I have none.
I have a question. So in regard to tier two, did we forecast what we expect? Well, we must have forecast what we expect tier two, the cost of tier two to do, and I would expect that it's going to go up. Mm-hmm. Relative, is that the case, and is that driving a lot of these future targets?
We did forecast tier two costs, both long term and short term. Mm-hmm. It is all. I think the best way to say this is it is not necessarily impacting the resource decision unless that tier two cost is different compared to other available options. So really, we're looking at the best available option at any given time to serve our load needs and our regulatory compliance needs. So resources themselves are also expensive over time.
Right.
So
I'm just looking for, I'll pick the future targets, 2035, for example. Mm-hmm. 35 megawatts of local solar, mm-hmm. 200 megawatts of utility scale clean energy. So
yeah.
I assume then that tier two is more expensive. We're predicting it to be more expensive than those options.
We are, the 200 megawatts of utility scale renewables, largely that is driven by load growth and our need to serve load, as well as our regulatory compliance needs in the 2030s. Tier two is an option there, but given the assumptions we have of regulatory compliance value of tier two,
okay.
It turns out that while it is less expensive,
it's probably not clean.
It doesn't have the same environmental
attributes. Yeah. Yes, thank you for reminding me of that.
A question, sure. That the past slide before this, the number six or seven, which is mm-hmm. the risk and opportunity. So I wonder what strategies are in place to reduce financial risk as we transition to more renewable resources.
Yep. So we have a discussion in there of several risks that could happen. Either we over-acquire or under-acquire. That is in there. I don't recall off the top of my head what those risks were, but we had mitigation strategies in there. I can get back to you with exactly what those say, or feel free to.
And also, I mentioned that as a clarification for people that listen. Sometimes they are not in the package as well. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we definitely included an analysis of the risks and mitigation strategies. Moving on, the CEIP is a separate document. It is related to the IRP, but it's a separate filing we have to make with State Commerce Department as part of the CETA Clean Energy Transformation Act. This is similar to the IRP and the biennial conservation targets for EIA. This one requires us to submit 4-year targets for conservation, demand response, and clean energy resources. And that is all accomplished. We find those targets through the IRP optimization process. One novel thing about the CEIP is it contains a geospatial forecast of cost-effective conservation and demand response by both census tract and by distribution circuit, so that we can attempt to target our vulnerable populations and highly impacted communities as defined within the CEIP. So we take our conservation, spread it out wherever it happens to live by census tract and circuit, and that is in a couple tables at the end of the CEIP.
This is Commissioner Olson.
Sure.
Mr. President, maybe I'm the only one that can you put the third bullet into Primer 101? What does that mean?
Sure. What we did is we took the available cost-effective conservation and demand response and took a look at where that availability was within the county or within the service territory,
okay,
by census tract, which is census-based, population-based, and then also by distribution circuit. We did that for conservation and demand response. That has an impact on the highly impacted communities and vulnerable population,
which are
one of them is defined for us and one of them is defined by us.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Yes, it did. Okay. That I understood.
So how to give us feedback, right? We're starting this sort of month-long feedback process. We always welcome comments here at these briefings. We really appreciate all the comments the commission has given us over the past 18 months. We did publish both the draft IRP and CEIP, as well as the Cliff Notes summary page to snowpud.com/IRP. Any comments from the public can be submitted to irp@snowpud.com. That goes to the entire team. We can incorporate those. And then the SEPA, which is the formal comment option through the State Environmental Policy Act, that period is open for 30 days until November 12th, 2025. So long time to get us comments. After that, we are going to start to finalize the IRP and prepare for final release in December. Brings us to next steps. So this isn't the end of the IRP process, but it is the beginning of the end of the IRP process. So we're gonna be back here with you to bring you the final IRP and CEIP documents on December 2nd. So we'll have start public hearings on the 2025 IRP, CEIP, and the 2026-2027 biennial conservation targets. And then on December 16th, we'll have considerations of resolutions to adopt those three items at the end of the year. And that brings us to the end of 2025 and a fully complete IRP process. Any questions for me?
Questions, commissioners?
Thank you for the presentation.
Commissioner Olson, do you have any questions? Other than geospatial. So I have a question. That's like sort of a hard question to answer. I don't know. Are we over IRP? So we've been in an environment where we didn't have enough resources and we were, you know, looking to the market and we were needing to build things and, you know, we changed our product. And obviously that doesn't get us all the way there, but that helps dramatically. So are we, I think you said 56 people that you said were involved.
That's our tech team. Yeah. So that's subject matter to experts across the district.
I'm just wondering, are we hitting, you know, with a hammer, it's too big.
Are you asking if we're doing too many IRPs?
No. Okay. Are we putting more effort into it than we need to meet our needs and the statutory needs? That's my question.
I understand the question. I don't believe so. I think this is a prudent method of forecasting for the PUD's best needs or the best resource plan to meet the PUD's needs over a long period of time. We have many opportunities to kind of go through this, right? We do this every couple of years. So update over time, but I would rather over prepare, that's the appropriate way of thinking about this, than maybe be caught off guard. I think having all of the feedback from our subject matter experts around the district mm-hmm. is more than valuable. Getting those perspectives from system planning, from key accounts, making sure that we have all of those perspectives, because we want this document to really give us a solid foundation for that long-term resource strategy. We want that strategy to withstand and hold up to the kind of scrutiny that you know, rightly give us. Mm-hmm. So I would say no, we are not over IRP.
I hope. Thank you.
Well, yeah. I would maybe put a little different spin on that and say we may have the opportunity, the spirit of continuous improvement, to figure out how do we get the same level of due diligence and outcomes that we need, and can we do it in a more efficient way? And that's just an ongoing, and the team has done that, but I think that's an ongoing opportunity. We want to make sure that we are getting all the right inputs, assessing, you know, the inputs, meaning internally and externally, assessing what the future is going to look like, and planning for that as well as we can. Are there better ways to do that? You know, in one of the meetings that Kim Johnson and I attended, we got to hear a futurist talk about how to assess or evaluate, you know, what's coming. And I think there may be ways for us to, you know, use different filters or look through different lenses as to how to plan for the future. And that's an ongoing opportunity for us. But I wouldn't want to back off on the kind of the exceptional level of due diligence that the team puts forward into this that really helps guide us moving forward.
Sorry, the future is talking about AI, IRB.
AI will be a part of it. But no.
Okay. Garrison.
Garrison Morris, Senior Manager of Power Supply. Provocative question. You've got the full battery of responses. Just wanted to add that, you know, one of the things that comes with being one of the largest customer-owned utilities in Washington State is we're also subject to really the largest volume of regulations around our planning obligations. So some of the things that we do are just things that come with that territory. But we do have a comprehensive IRP every 4 years, and the CEIP and all the things that come with it. And, you know, every 2 years, it's a very slimmed down update version there. So we will have a lighter process, the 2027 IRP, if that's any consolation, but we're living in the world that we're living in as well in terms of satisfying those regulations.
I appreciate those responses. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent job to the entire IRP team. All right, last up on presentations is to the cloud for technology upgrade and Christy Sterling. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. That's great. All right. Thank you very much. Really happy to be able to come talk to you about a really significant technology upgrade that ultimately will be quite a bit of work, but really catapult us into the next level of what our technology offers in support of district strategic initiatives and our core operations. My name is Christy Sterling. I'm the Chief Information Officer. I also have with me Doris Payne, who is our IT Program Director for this project, and she will be wrapping up a little bit of information about schedules and next steps towards the end. Today's presentation is really an informational presentation for you about the crucial need for this core technology platform upgrade. In case you've heard it referenced this way before, our core technology that we're talking about is SAP. SAP is the vendor and the product that we're talking about. So it is the core technology, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through the presentation. We are preparing you for future decisions that you would make related to this SAP product and the related technologies and our system integrator, which is the consultants that help you implement a large technology upgrade like we're planning. Please, if you have questions, as always, stop me along the way. On this slide, I know there's a lot of information on the right. That's really more of a visual for you to understand the scope of what we're talking about. The details, we aren't going to go through all the details of that today. SAP, or this core technology, is the backbone of all of our systems and solutions at the district related to core office operations, if you will, finance, HR, customer service operations. It also is an integration point for operational technology platforms, and our customer web portal, things like that are all integrated to this core platform and sourced out of the data that's contained within this core technology. So the technology is platform. Again, it integrates business processes across the district and enables many things like analysis, reporting, and just it's the technology that helps us do our daily job. It's critical to many of our core functions, and any disruption could impact billing, payroll, customer service, all of which are sourced out of this core technology. So if you look on the right, you'll see there are many touch points in our operation that really depend on our SAP product. So the question is, why are we here today, and why must we upgrade this, and why is there some urgency to do so? Our contract with SAP and our current technology ends in 2027, SAP has made a very strategic move to move away from this old technology platform that they're on, much of which is kind of old servers on-premise, housed in a data center here with a mix of some solutions that are hosted in their cloud environment. So it's really their older technology platform, and they've made a strategic decision to upgrade that to a cloud-based solution. So something that's hosted in a data center, a cloud data center. Our current system will go unsupported as of 2027. SAP will no longer support the current platform that we are on in the way that we have contracted now as that contract expires. That means as they start to move away from this core technology platform and go to their new platform, they're no longer investing in keeping this old platform up to date and running. So we would be in a situation where they wouldn't be doing security updates on this old platform, they wouldn't provide technical support, and they certainly wouldn't be adding features or enhancements. They're putting all their resources into their newest platform, and they're requiring all of their customers to upgrade to that new platform. The result of that would be increased vulnerabilities to cyber threats, some reduction in our opportunity to keep our system up to date, and ultimately, we wouldn't have the ability to continue to enhance it to meet our strategic needs moving forward. So while bottom line there, it's not a choice, it's a technology-driven deadline, that's not to imply that you don't have choices in this matter, but it is really to identify that SAP, the vendor that provides this core technology, has made the choice for all of their customers that they are moving to the new technology. They will not support the old technology, and they have given a very firm deadline for doing that. Is this any questions?
Yeah, can you put this in context with how much of the market SAP has? I hear SAP everywhere from all kinds of companies, so it seems like it's 100%, but can you?
Oh, sure, that is a big question, and I'll give you an idea. I don't think I can give you the percentage of the market, but what I can tell you is some information behind SAP. I think one of their taglines in a commercial at one point in time was SAP runs the world, and it's pretty true. You see them everywhere. And that's not just utility industry, although the utility industry is certainly a vertical that they support. They also support manufacturing, shipping, everything that you can imagine. So I think your question is more about the utility industry. And there are thousands of implementations of SAP in utilities across the world. And many, many hundreds of SAP customers in the US in the utility market. That includes very large IOUs, investor-owned utilities. It also includes public utilities like ourselves. When we're talking about this migration, we'll get to a little bit further down as far as the number of migrations that have already happened and where we fit in the mix. I'll say that we are right in the middle of US utilities, many of which have already moved forward with this upgrade. We're in that middle that are just now getting ready to do the upgrade. There's a few that are undecided, and we'll talk about that. I'm jumping ahead, so I don't want to get off that slide because it'll make a little bit more sense when we get there.
And what this means is for the people that listen to us.
That's a great question. And there is a German translation for what SAP means. It is now just really referred to as SAP. People don't really know it as anything else. It's not like an acronym. I think it was rooted originally in an acronym, but now it's just the name of the company.
Okay. It's a monopoly, maybe.
Well, that's a great question. I wouldn't call it a monopoly because there is there are two really primary solution providers in this space. The other is Oracle. So you might have heard of Oracle too. I would classify them both as very similar and equal in kind of how they dominate the market. And then there's some that are much smaller that don't bring the technical solutions that complex utilities are looking for. More like smaller utilities or co-ops, things like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Want to start a little bit with some key project principles. I think this is important for you to know how we're approaching this because it is a really significant effort. It's costly and it takes a lot of resource time. First and foremost, our approach was to spend wisely. We want to be good stewards of the district's finances and of our ratepayers' finances, even though this is a pretty significant project. So our approach has been we will only buy what we truly need, focusing on essential features. How this manifested itself already is we've spent several months really diving in with SAP to ensure that every line item and everything that they're selling is something that truly meets what we're using today or what we need. I'll say that their original bill of materials that they provided to us when we started this was much more costly than where we're landing today. I'd say it was around $7.5 million annually for their subscription. And that's because there was a lot of overhead and line items that we truly found we didn't need. So we went through and have been with a fine tooth comb, our architects, Doris, SAP's architect, and really scrutinizing every line item. And so we've knocked off about 65% of that overall bill. And so that's why we spent quite a bit of time doing this. So we really are focused on only doing what we need and purchasing it at the time that we need it. Again, this minimizes costs and protects customers' rates to the extent that we can with this, with the technology that we need to run the district. The other things that we're looking at is trying to keep this simple, and I use that maybe with some air quotes. It's a pretty complex project, but really keeping it simple and useful. That means for us, we'll use proven tools and best practices, and we'll try and move away from a lot of customizations. Customizations are costly, and while they're necessary sometimes, they do add additional overhead. So we're really trying to force ourselves to really streamline processes and figure out how we can best utilize the system that we're purchasing. Finally, managing risk and building stability. We have a strong governance process. We're looking at a phased delivery approach, and we're being transparent in what we're reporting, again, so that we can help identify risks and ensure that we're managing those in a prudent way.
Commissioner Logan, this is Commissioner Olson. I do have a question on this slide. The first column to the left, spend wisely. We're buying only the features that we need now, but it's such that in the future we want to enhance or add new features. This will accommodate that without having to rebuild a lot of stuff.
That's a great question, Commissioner Olson. And yes, that is truly what we are accomplishing here. We're trying to minimize what we purchase, but know that we can always buy add-ons or do additional enhancements in the future. That's certainly a part of this project. This is really just about trying to target really what we need and challenge ourselves to minimize what we have to the extent that we can without hurting operations, but also leaving it open that we can add in the future if that is so necessary. And what we would do is we would just bring those contract changes or additions back to you in the future. But that would be kind of an ongoing enhancement of the system.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So I wanted to cover the options that we considered and why we're recommending moving forward with this upgrade now approach. So upgrade now, it is really investing in moving to that next SAP platform before support ends. We do have a few options and we've looked at those options and listed them here. There is a possibility to delay the upgrade to the last possible moment. That would mean pushing it out instead of doing it in 2026 and 27, pushing it more to 28 and 29 before the absolute drop dead date by 2030. Part of the challenge with that is SAP is deprecating or already getting rid of some of the key features and systems that are included in this overall portfolio. So we would have to figure out how to bridge that timeline. After 2027, when we would have to renew our contract for existing licensing, SAP's already indicated to all of their customers that that will come at a premium. So they will uptick the cost significantly to stay on the existing licenses. We won't get the same costs that we're doing now. So it will increase the cost. And then there's just added risk for those years that we remain supported by SAP. Similar to that, we can remain, so that would be upgrading later. We would still focus on the upgrade. We would have more costs between now and that upgrade time. And then we would still have to pay for this upgrade inevitably. For some time, we could remain on the unsupported solution. And that's what we have now as far as servers. And we played out, what would that look like? Could we stay on that even longer beyond SAP's end of support? And that becomes really difficult and risky. Yes, Commissioner?
I have a question of clarification regarding the timeline for the upgrade and also the cost, the total cost. How much is going to be, and it's going to be for a period, and then we're going to upgrade again, and then a few years, and then we're going to do it again. So
that is a great
question. That is a forecasting that you have for those expenses.
Yes, and I'll show that on the next slide, I believe. And I can jump to that. I'll just say that remaining unsupported on current old servers would include many things like having to upgrade our current hardware stack, which is about $1 million to just do that upgrade. There's a lot of costs related to remaining unsupported. And then another question that I'm sure is on clients is, can we just switch to another vendor? Commissioner, you already asked an important question. Is there anyone else in the market? Oracle would be that other vendor. We would not see a significant cost savings on the year-to-year licensing of that likely. Moving to a whole new platform is even more costly. There's a lot more to re-engineering all of our workflows, retraining all of our employees. We would basically be going through the same process, but with a brand new vendor. It also tends to be a really risky venture for utilities. Implementing new enterprise systems do come at some risks.
Thank you.
And I can come back to the slide if there's more questions, but let me jump to let me skip this slide. This just kind of talks about the risks. I can come back to that if you want, but I'd like to get to your question. This is high-level view of the costs, and yes, you're absolutely right. Over the next 3 years, there would be significant investment in the actual implementation costs for this, along with running our current system. But after 2027 and 2028, when we're actually implemented, then we'll just go back down to the yearly cost of managing SAP, and that's about $3.5 million annually. So you will see these costs down. The internal costs will go back down as well, because this is representative of a lot of people working on this project to implement. So after the implementation and the cutover from our old system to new system, we will then move back down to more annual costs. You also asked a really important question about future upgrades. One of the benefits of moving to this cloud solution is there are continual improvement upgrades that the vendors push. If you think about Microsoft is a great example. Everyone went to their cloud product, and we see periodic pushes that come out. They keep their system up to date, and they can push those faster. What you don't see is large-scale upgrades of the technology, if you will, like we have now. So where we're at now is about every 5 to 7 years, we have to do a massive upgrade of the hardware that we manage and support. That's usually about $1 million of investment in project to do that. But then we also have to do periodic upgrades to stay on the latest version of SAP. That actually gets easier because the hardware is in data centers the cloud data centers that are managed elsewhere. So we no longer have the hardware costs, and they're moving away from those forklift upgrade costs that we see kind of in older technology.
And this total estimated cost, it won't change
this
in the future. I mean, that you present these amounts of money, but it exists the possibility that maybe perhaps in 2026 or 2027, they say, oh, sorry, we're going to increase this percentage or something like that.
No, these costs won't. Well, we hope that through our final negotiations with contracts with our system integrator and with SAP, that some of this will come down a bit. We think we've been conservative in these estimates. So we are hoping that over the next few months, we might see this come down a little. It might not be a lot. What we won't see is large scale SAP saying, now you have to do another upgrade in 2028 and it's going to cost you more. Any additional things to this cost would likely be driven by us saying we want new technology. That makes sense.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Commissioner Olson. Before you go on, I think this kind of builds. Now I've got 2 points. Number one, postponing it or bringing on a different product is a nightmare. And I think your estimates here for those are low, having been through that. Anyway, and also when I'm looking on this slide 8, internal costs, that's the cost of our labor, correct?
That's correct.
Our labor, materials, time.
That's correct.
That's correct, yeah. So I kind of call that soft costs. It's just that concurrent labor is just being directed to this project. So I think you kind of have to look at that number a little differently.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The internal labor represented here are employees that are coming on and dedicating time to their
right.
work.
Yeah.
There, in all transparency, there may be some limited backfill positions that are temporary if there's work in departments that these people do that can't be offloaded. So there might be some costs there, but certainly the vast majority of resources related to this project are related to employees, subject matter experts, project managers,
right.
IT team that are all dedicating their time and resources.
Right.
These are people that are already existing at the
right.
district.
Okay, thank you.
And I just—
Thank you for making that point, Commissioner.
Sorry. And I do want to say you touched on really an important thing, Commissioner. The switch for vendors, I think this is fairly conservative at roughly $200 million. I can tell you much, it is a larger utility, but one of the utilities that has chosen to switch from SAP to Oracle is CPS Energy. And we know for sure that their project is about $320 million to do that.
Thank you.
So I do want to touch on what customers can gain from this project. We're really talking about a lot of resource and complexity and time, and I know that's a big ask. I do want to touch on some things that are a positive that we'll see coming out of this. As you move into new technologies, we'll likely see faster response time, which leads to improved customer interactions. More intuitive onboarding and training. One of the biggest challenges with SAP, I think you would have any of our employees or probably anyone that uses products like this, is they're not so user-friendly or intuitive when you're actually doing your work. And the new solution does offer a much better user interface, which means that onboarding people goes faster. We've gotten some feedback from peers that have already implemented the new call center technology with SAP, and that for one has been widely received and with a lot of positive input that is a lot easier to use. So all of that should increase customer satisfaction because we're giving better tools to the frontline employees who are serving our customers. Again, better customer experience overall, better mobile access for people who are out in the field or traveling between offices, streamlined workflows, and reducing manual tasks are all part of this new technology solution. And all that leads to operational efficiencies, which in turn relates to better more accurate data, better decision-making, more efficient financial operations, all of which we do really well with our current system. This is just providing us those tools to enhance what we do.
How does this impact security? You know, it's one of the questions I get most often. People have had suffered with so many data hacks and had their personal data lost so many times. They're always worried about their data with PUD. I assume that you've got to be in the new software eventually before it sunsets to maintain all the security aspects. But can you elaborate?
Yeah, I absolutely can. And I really appreciate that you always have eyes on security. I know all of you do. And it's something that's core to what we deliver. For some time now, we've taken a security first model in any known technology implementation. And this is the same. What this does is it allows SAP to continue to provide the security that they provide. Again, they manage businesses all over the world. It's in their best interest to keep their systems up to date and secure. However, we can't rely only on one vendor. So we have a whole ecosystem of security controls that we will continue to apply and checks and balances to monitor to ensure that the security continues to be at the greatest level that it can be. That includes a product that we implemented some time ago called Onapsis, which specifically looks at SAP security vulnerabilities in our configuration and allows us to see if there's anything that we should apply that we haven't. So we're really taking that check and balance. It will be similar to that approach.
And also for the protection safety for the cyber attacks, right?
Yes. Yes, again, multifaceted approach to cybersecurity. And while this is moving to a cloud solution, so again, not hosted in our data center, hosted in a cloud data center, we will be able to work with SAP to protect our instance of SAP. They have strong security protocols, again, for the vendor. And we also will continue to have our checks and balances in it. Additional monitoring and security, not only for this product, but again, this product will work over our network. So we have to maintain security protocols for our network. So, and then also just ongoing training for employees. So security is multifaceted and we're not changing that approach, but what we are doing is working with the vendors to make sure that that's baked into this deployment.
And I'm just curious, when you talk about employee experience, mobile access for field and remote employees, could you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We have field access for our employees now. The line crews, anyone who's working in the field, they take their laptop out and they can access the systems that they need, whether it's our geospatial solution or SAP. SAP, this new product has additional capabilities that we'll implement to hopefully make the mobile solution more transparent and easier to navigate. Just one thing that I know that people are looking forward to is, you know, as managers or supervisors are out in the field, the ability to approve work orders through a good user interface on their mobile device. Things like that are more difficult to do today. The intent is to make those easier on an updated mobile application of SAP.
Thank you.
Take you back a few moments to when you talked about user adoption and how many people or how many companies were utilizing SAP. So over 60 utilities in the US and Canada have already adopted and upgraded to the new platform. So they were on various versions of SAP, old versions of SAP. 60 utilities have already adopted this new platform and implemented. More than 4,400 utilities worldwide use the new upgraded solution. So again, when you think about the scope of every utility that's utilizing SAP, a lot of companies have already gone on this journey. The majority of our peer utilities are upgrading. They're not switching vendors. As you can see, we're only aware of two or three vendors that are choosing to jump from one solution to another. And again, Commissioner Olson said it really well. That is a huge and risky venture. And I'm sure those companies will be successful, but it is more costly and tremendously more risky. Not that it can't be done, but there is a lot to that. You can see we are right in the middle where we are, I'd say we're transitioning hopefully from the planning upgrade to active upgrade projects. So getting ready to start the upgrade. And so we're right in the middle third there. There are some utilities right behind us that are a few months, several months behind where we are. That's an important thing because as that group of 50 utilities in the US start to look for system integrators to help them with their implementation, the best resources that those system integrators will start to be consumed by other utility projects. So again, it's a little bit about timing just to make sure that we have the opportunity to get really good, solid resources from all of the vendors that are engaged in this upgrade. And then I'm going to invite Doris up. You will start to hear more from Doris, depending on how often you want to hear updates about this large program. Doris, again, is the program director, and I couldn't stress enough that we are in good hands. She has several large implementations under her belt. She's an architect and a project manager and a program director. She's done it all. And so I want to introduce Doris, and she'll talk to you about the last two slides.
Thank you, Christy. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Doris Payne, and I'm the IT program director assigned to lead our team through this big important project that we're getting ready to go on. We've been working over the past year with vendors and requests for proposals, and we are getting very close to being able to come back to you hopefully by the end of the year with some contracts for approval to move forward with a system integrator, which, as Christy described, is the key industry expert that has done this type of migration a number of times and will partner with us and lead our team through the migration to the cloud. We are also looking at a new asset lifecycle accounting solution that will help our finance and enterprise asset management teams better manage our assets. That is a piece in SAP that we use today that SAP decided to take out of its future product. So we had to find a replacement for that. We're also looking at mobility contracts. We're looking at a third party called Murata Forms to work with SAP to help improve that user experience. There's another contract out there that we are looking at with a company called Equidox. What Equidox does is they'll help us with migrating the solution that we use to manage all of our utility invoices and all of our, I would say, highly formatted documents, such as customer correspondence that our customer service department develops. And so we published the RFP back in May. We had a very strong evaluation committee, and we had a unanimous decision to move forward with the vendor that we will be bringing to you in December. We are also simultaneously working on the negotiation with SAP, as Christy described. We are targeting to bring that back to you in December. And we also are looking at an RFP for an IT service management, ITSM. What that is, that's the system that manages our help desk. So whenever you need to call 8351 and ask for help and they track your incident or your request for help, that is another solution that we had to find a replacement for because that's not in the new SAP system. We're looking to start the project in quarter one, January, if all goes to plan. And then we would spend the first 6 months planning the migration with our system integrator, software vendors. And as Christy described, the spend wisely, we are only going to include in our initial SAP contract the things we are absolutely certain we need. In planning, we may find something as we dig deep into the details of the design of certain aspects. We may have to come back for another update to that contract. So we've put a placeholder in to come back somewhere around Q2 if we need it. And then at the end of the planning, we will start the work. It's roughly 13 months of work with all of the district employees, our systems integrator, and the vendors to start this migration. We're targeting going live in the third quarter of 2027. We're trying to get there before storm season starts. And then we'll go into a 3-month, what we call hypercare, where the project team stays together to make sure that we can respond to any unforeseen things that happen. They always happen as the system breaks in. Then we've reserved roughly 1 year after we get to the cloud. There will be things that we couldn't get to as part of our migration, things that we're calling critical pain points, but things that if we could spend a little more time, we don't want to jeopardize getting there by 2027. We would take a look at, can we improve those pain points so that we can have a better process for our end users? And we're also looking at our energy services team at that point. So we have, that'll be a time-boxed year where we implement innovations that our end users want out of this. So that's the high level. It's the schedule. It's kind of the game plan, because this is how we want to manage it and try to drive all the activities to this plan. Questions about this?
Commissioner Logan, this is Commissioner Olson. I do have a question. Our current product is no longer supported after 2026, 2027.
The date that SAP has given us for being off of our current contract is the end of 2027. That's the same date they've given all of their customers. And as Christy said, then we go into a customer specific maintenance, which will be very expensive. And there's a lot of other.
Well, the reason, thank you for clarifying that. The reason I'm asking is this is, you know, we're talking about corporate core enterprise systems, which I'm assuming with all of the intricacies of that. This is an aggressive schedule, I'm assuming, and go live is in quarter three of 2027. Are we 100% sure or 75% sure? I just don't want us to back us up to January 2028 and not have a system.
Yeah, this is Christy Sterling again, Commissioner Olson. That's certainly insightful. This is an aggressive timeline, but we feel like it's a reasonable timeline. We do have a little bit of time towards the end where we can, you know, accommodate a minimal amount of slide. This is why we've taken minimal viable product is what we're calling an MVP approach, to making sure that we focus on the upgrade and only the things that we really have to focus on in those in the first phases, in phase 0 through 2. And while we're going to push out any enhancements or more complex stuff, if possible, to post go live. So we're really trying to focus on getting to that core technology upgrade by the end of 2027. I will say that some things that give me confidence, one is we have experience with the system integrator that we're utilizing. Two, we have an incredibly experienced team internally, both on our business department sides, but also on our IT side. We have a team of SAP experienced employees. We've had a couple of runs at upgrades, although not this complex, but we've met the timelines for our core technology upgrades when we were upgrading our current solution. And We had an aggressive timeline when we implemented SAP, when we went wall-to-wall SAP in 2015 and 2016. That was a really aggressive timeline as well. We were able to meet that timeline back then, and the scope and the complexity was much more, and we didn't have the knowledgeable internal team that we do now. So I would be, I don't want to give you an absolute that we wouldn't run into some bumps along the way on this.
Well, I'm not expecting that. No, I just wanted to.
Absolutely, something that we will drive to make sure that we meet the timeline to avoid the running over beyond the 2027 contract.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Chris, do I hear up there at the podium? Can you back up to number slide number 3 for a moment? I just want to make sure I understand.
You said
number 3, the third. It's the one we, so this one. So we didn't talk about the right because it's a lot of stuff on there. But as I go back and look at the right in more detail, I mean, this is most of our organization.
True.
It's running on the system. I just wanted to make sure.
That is absolutely true. And what's not running on the system is integrated to the system by and large, with some exceptions. So I would say characterize this as what's not in SAP or not in this core solution is our operational technology. Our grid technology.
Yeah.
And so, but that interfaces to this. So you're absolutely right. This is a vast majority of what we do at the district.
This is how we track John.
It is how we track John.
You can find him in the hall.
More importantly, this is how you pay John. So.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, that's fine. These are great questions. I also, relative to this timeline, and as Christy mentioned, during planning, the SI will be identifying which things will be in phase 2 versus phase 3. And part of the criteria is making sure that it doesn't jeopardize our go live in 2027. The other thing I wanted to say is that the vendor that we selected has over 200 of the like migrations across various sectors. So they have a lot of experience with this. We also, the vendor that we did select, we have experience with. This was the same vendor that we used for our AMI systems integration. So here's our schedule. So Cognizant was selected unanimously by our evaluation committee to be our systems integrator. We also selected our asset lifecycle accounting software replacement from Cognizant. We're targeting bringing that contract back to you. As I said, we're in parallel working on a software agreement with SAP. We're also targeting December for that one. There's a third set of contracts in place with Equidocs around our the upgrade to that solution that handles our utility invoices and all of our other highly formatted forms. We're targeting December-ish, may go into January for that. We have an RFP out right now for replacement for our ITSM or Health Nets replacement solution sometime in next quarter. And then, as I mentioned, we're planning on possibly coming back in Q1 or Q2 next year once we get into the design. Any other questions?
Commissioners?
I have none. Thank you for the presentation.
Mr. Olson, any more questions?
Just one last question. The budget as is represented in this presentation, is that the budget to get us to go live point?
Yes, that budget right there reflects the project cost to get us to go live.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah, fantastic job, Lawrence and Christy, and really huge kudos to the amount of work that they've already put in some of the due diligence to set us up in a good way moving forward. That is it for the presentations.
Don, let's take a short break.
Sure.
So it's 10:39. Let's come back at 10:50, and we are back.
Next up is item four, our CEO General Manager. What there is one for today, John?
You have a couple things to share. First up, from Government Relations, district team met with the Mayor of Burnsville, Mayor Nearing, and city staff to provide an update on the Getchell Station and Transmission Line project. The meeting covered the project's purpose, location, and timeline. Team presented a refreshed project overview followed by a collaborative discussion on outreach and communication strategies. We've been invited to continue this dialogue at the City Council workshop in November. Colin Willenbrock and Amy Karstens contributed valuable insights by explaining the project's necessity and objectives, and I know Brenda White was also a significant part of that discussion. Our Women Empowered and the Transportation Department hosted a vehicle safety event on October 8th. Attendees learned about basic vehicle maintenance, roadside emergency skills, and winter driving preparedness. Also, Laura Lemke served on the Planning Committee for the Western Energy Institute, WEI, Strategic Planning Conference. She presented on how our 2040 scenario planning work informed our strategic plan, as well as offered insights into how we are driving our strategic plan execution through accountability and timely progress reporting. I also want to explain and justify my absence for the last couple weeks. Kim Johnston said it reminded her of the TV show Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. I had an APPA Executive Committee and Board meeting, an NWPPA Executive Committee and Board meeting. I was able to join Scott Corwin, the APPA CEO. He and I kicked off the APPA Legal and Legislative Conference. And I also attended the LPPC Steering Committee and CEO meeting. Lots of good stuff happening around the country in public power. But also one of the most significant themes is the significant cost challenges. Cost challenges and then the resulting rate increases that utilities are having to go through in order to meet historical load increases due to, you know, as we saw earlier today with the load forecast, EV electrification. This all includes building new substations or upsizing capacity on existing substations, building distribution lines, etc. At the same time, where we are trying to achieve aggressive decarbonization goals. And it's not just us. I mean, Washington State, we have our own certainly unique aggressive decarbonization goal, but this is a common theme across the country. That coupled with work to increase reliability and resiliency in light of a greater number of storms and the storms being much more severe, and dollars we're spending on vegetation management and adding infrastructure that can help minimize the number of outages and the duration of outages, as well as significant dollars having to be spent on wildfire mitigation. One other point is there's still some significant inflationary impact on costs and or cost increases on electric utility equipment and materials. We had a couple utilities that are trying to build new combined cycle gas power plants and, you know, invest in other ways on their system. And prices in some cases have doubled. One example was the utility in Jacksonville, Florida, building a 450-ish megawatt combined cycle gas plant. Original costs were in the $800 million. It is now escalated to $1.3 billion. So just an example of the significant cost increase. Again, in hearing all of the utility peers across the country, it certainly made me appreciate that, you know, we've had the last few years rate increases that we haven't been, you know, necessarily excited about, but we are well below the industry trend, the electric utility trend in over the past few years, and then even what is forecasted going forward, let alone that our current rates are far, far below utility average across the country. So it's just, again, lots of good stuff discussed, some of the things that utilities are doing to try to minimize cost impacts, as well as, you know, continue to try to increase the customer experience, customer engagement, lots of good things going on. Also, just to report for your awareness, open enrollment will run from October 29th through November 13th. It is that time of year again. And I can't forget because I did that one time and our medical plan and family life. That's all I have. But maybe that's why I'm so sensitive. I'll make sure everybody.
Any questions for John, commissioners? Report comments. Thank you, John. Next, we have public hearing, item 5.5A, continuing the 2026 proposed budget hearing. I will now convene a public hearing on the 2026 proposed budget. And I will introduce Sarah Vaughn, a stranger to anonymous. We'll facilitate the presentation.
You see a lot of me in call, that is for sure.
The leaves change color. And you can hear.
Well, today I'm here, so we're gonna have the second of four public hearings on the 26th budget. Today is just for information and discussion. We won't be asking for approval until December 2nd. So today, you know, kind of tie together a lot of the things actually we heard about earlier today, kind of funny how it all works out. But today we're gonna talk a little bit about how we spend money. Last time I spent time talking about where our money comes from. So we're gonna look at our uses of funds, which is our purchase power, our operating and maintenance, and our capital. And we're going to take a look at our five-year forecast and some of the assumptions and our expected reserves. So let's start with how do we spend our money? So this graph just kind of shows all of the big pieces of our cash spending. Our purchase power is our biggest at 33%. Operations and maintenance at $308 million, 32%. Capital and debt service payments are about 30%, and then taxes. And this graph is gross, right? These are the gross costs. A lot of these have offsets. So, and I wanted to highlight the capital component especially. We do have a large capital budget this year, though there are a lot of, we have contributions that offset some of these costs. We've got about $10 million in grant proceeds that offset these costs. And we've got about $60 million in bond proceeds that offset these costs. So if you take our $243 million, and really the cost in our rates is $183 million. So just wanted to make sure to point that out.
There is the project we just looked at, does that get capitalized?
Yes, that is a capital project, correct. So we just take a look at just purchase power. We'll take that first section since it's one of our biggest pieces. We've got four major areas in our power cost. Number one, of course, the largest is our Bonneville Power, about 77%. We've talked a lot about load following. I've got another slide to speak on that, what goes into that component. We, of course, also have our own generation system, which is our Jackson, Youngs Creek, Hancock, and Callaghan. Things have changed a little bit with load following. Now some of that power is being remarketed. We've got our renewable sources, which include primarily our wind projects. And again, some of that power is being remarketed as part of the switch to load following. And then you've got some presentations on renewable energy credits, another portion of our power portfolio. We wanted to do a little bit of a deep dive into load following just because it is such a significant piece of our budget. Lots of changes between how things have been prior. It's been a huge pivot for the budget office for us to kind of learn and wrap our head around all of these pieces, but kind of wanted to just walk through a little bit what it looks like. So if you take, you know, the first section, I wanted to show what 24 looked like, what the 25 budget was, and then what we're looking at now in the 26 budget. And if you look just at the cost of power for BPA, you can see some savings from the 2025 budget. And that's just the cost of the product. Another significant change, and I have a slide on this later, is a transmission and ancillary services. We're expecting a decrease, so we're seeing some savings there. Probably one of the largest impacts is the market purchases line. You can see that no longer are we budgeting for market purchases. So we no longer have to worry about the 2024 number, those sort of numbers coming our way. Down at the bottom, we also, the one thing also at the same time, though, we're not going to be on the market in the same way as we were selling power. Now it's more term contract sales of the sources that we have, so we'll see less revenue there. But then we'll also have the sale of excess transmission capacity going up a little bit too. So net-net, if you do the math between the 25 budget and the 26 budget, it's about a $50 million savings.
Commissioner Logan, this is Commissioner Olson. I am particularly on cloud nine when there's no number by market.
Well, you so sound like to cloud say. Nine too much. The speakers are directly above our heads.
And just taking a quick look at our other renewable power purchases and other, we've got our three long-term wind contracts, Wheatfield, White Creek, and Hay Canyon, about $30 million a year. Again, some of that power is going to be remarketed. We've got the Arlington Battery Storage Project. This is the first year we've seen this in the budget, about $2.8 million in 2026, we're expecting. Okay. Other renewables, we've got Packwood and Hampton, about $2 million in 2026. And then we've, as I said, you've been briefed on our renewable energy credits. We're expected to send about $6.3 million in 2026 to make sure that we're compliant with the Energy Independence Act.
Yes.
Only for clarification, this is what we need to pay, right?
Correct. Okay. This is the payment part, yes. So generation system, again, part of our power portfolio, cost incurred by the generation system are paid for by the electric system as part of the purchase power. And again, beginning with the load following product, energy generated by Hancock and Callaghan are going to be marketed, remarketed to bring in additional revenue, which were the numbers I showed you earlier. And then Youngs, Jackson, and Woods Creek will be continued to meet demands under the terms of a load following product. I included a sample of the budget for the generation system this year. Just wanted to point out that it's a little bit higher than 2026. The cost in this energy sales is the amount that gets passed forward to the electric system as purchased power. There are just some pretty significant projects out of Jackson right now. They're doing some switchyard redesign. So that's the main driver of that increase. Taking a switch to operations and maintenance, this slide just kind of shows the breakdown by what we call divisions of the district and kind of just where the work is being done. I like this slide because it just kind of shows just the amount of work that we do here at the district. We'll start up with distribution and engineering, of course, is our largest division, and they're the ones who hold the budget for our energy emergency restoration, vegetation management, our energy control center, community offices, et cetera. We also have the cost of transmitting power from generation facilities from PPA, which is about 14% of our costs. Customer and energy services is our next largest. This includes our customer service group, our key accounts, all of our energy services, which we'll talk about, and meter reading. Information technology, this is where all of the cost of our maintaining all of our computer systems, maintain cybersecurity, data and analytics, et cetera. We've got finance, which of course includes our insurance and claims, accounting, budgeting, customer accounting, contracts purchasing. Facilities are the ones that manage all of our, maintain our PUD facilities, all of our custodial services, facilities planning, maintenance of our buildings, et cetera. And then there's all the other smaller departments, human resources, communications, administration, et cetera. So this is just kind of a breakdown of how money is spent from a divisional standpoint. I thought it'd be interesting this year to highlight just some of the bigger ticket items that we have in our O&M budget. We've got about $9 million allocated to our tree trimming vegetation management, which is intended to cover about 400 miles of distribution line and 80 miles of transmission lines. Facilities maintenance, we're doing some HVAC control upgrades. I believe it's in this building. Then we've got our landscaping contracts and all of our facilities. And then just our internal facilities, utility costs, those are some facilities, bigger ticket items. Substation maintenance, of course, a larger item. So this is basically the amount for all these options on our substations. Computer licensing and support. We've got some of our annual maintenance contracts, our telephone services, et cetera. Security guard services, so this is in our facilities area. We've got 24/7 coverage at our local utilities. It's about $2 million a year. Customer payments processing, this is so our customers can pay fees electronically. And our property liability insurance, part of our O&M costs. I mean, I know you've been briefed very much on what these are. So just some interesting bigger ticket items that we have in our O&M budget. I want to talk a little bit about emergency work. This is some of this lies in capital, some of this lies in O&M. I want to talk a little bit about, we have this umbrella of emergency work that we do here at the district. And there's really two different terminologies that we use when we're talking about emergency. One is blue sky. I put that in quotes because I've heard people call it different things. For some reason, that's one that comes to my mind. But those are basically just our routine restoration activities, right? So we have somebody hit our pole, just a call out, or if we have like just kind of some minor weather events, that's our blue sky work. And now, of course, we have our major significant storms. So these are ones that basically are triggered by large scale events. They're sometimes declared major, and they can involve mutual aid. And historically, they've qualified for FEMA reimbursement. So one of our budget discussions this year was, what is the proper funding level for emergency work this year? So we did some analysis and we looked at some historical spend, and we did increase our emergency work budget to cover what we believe are adequate levels based on what we've been seeing. So that brings our blue sky budget funding to $14.5 million and our major weather event funding at $5.6 million.
And this is, I assume, a direct result of understanding that FEMA is less likely to help us than it has been.
That's definitely part of the conversation with the House. Thank you for that.
Commissioner Logan, this is Commissioner Olson. So the major weather event funding is 5.6, correct?
That is correct.
How much does one storm cost?
You know, it really can vary. We've had major storm events, and so if you look at the history of what we've qualified as major storm, it could be small as $3 million a year. It could be as large as $20 million a year.
Yeah.
It really just depends on the scope and nature of that.
Okay. So this is on the low end, 5.6.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and that would be to, maybe this is with a little bit of hope that we don't have, you know, a major, that the, you know, 10, 12 plus million dollar storm, but once every 3 to 5 years. Looking at overall annual average down a little bit.
Yeah, Tony isn't asking for big storms. I just kind of take a realistic look at that in our most recent past. And hope we only have 5.6. If we have any, they don't go over 5.6.
Yeah, I'm with you. This has been a topic that I have dealt with for a lot of years, is how do you anticipate the number of storms and or the impact of those storms, the severity of the storms, and therefore the dollar impact. And you want to try to get it as close as possible, because if you overfund it, then you're asking customers to pay up front. We don't want to do that. And if we do have a big storm, then oftentimes we have to reprioritize the work anyway to accommodate the storm and accommodate the resulting financial impact. So I think Sarah and team have done a fantastic job to try to get as close to realistic as we can on an annual basis.
Yeah, I see that. And I do, Sarah, I have one last question. Are these numbers already in, you know, you have your different cost elements for materials, labor. Are these dollars already in those line items?
They are, yes. These are the numbers you've seen already. Correct.
All right. Thank you.
So, John, are you saying that because we have our crews doing so much of our own capital improvements, upgrades, that if we have a major storm, that spend drops?
Oftentimes, you will have to
because
adjust.
They're spending, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Well, I should hope for a big CapEx number. We need our CapEx target. Yeah. Not to be under it.
Yes.
Okay.
Last but not least, on our own end is our energy efficiency programs. We have a portion of our budget that's dedicated to our energy efficiency programs to help incentivize our customers to conserve energy. So just a breakdown, I won't go through all of the programs. There's more information in the budget book if you're interested. So the gross budget is $22.6 million. However, there's quite a few offsets. We're budgeted to receive about $3 million for our HEARS grant, continuing from this year, which will help pay, and then about $9 million of it is expected to be reimbursed by BPA. Transmission and ancillary services, I a little bit of this information was already in the load following, but just a reminder of one of the benefits of switching to load following was a decrease in our transmission costs. So you can see we've gone from about 62 million to about 48 million.
I'm sorry, can you go back to the, so what is other EE programs, 3.1 million? Is the yellow color?
I'm trying to know what's in there. That might just be the cost of all of the labor related to these programs, but I would have to get back to, I'm not sure if anybody.
This is other EE.
Yeah.
Sorry. Good morning, John Hoffman, Chief Customer Officer. We actually have a variety of energy efficiency programs that are probably too small to fit in the bar, which is why they're showing up there. So things like our mobile home weatherization program that we're planning on doing, or our multifamily unit program that we're kicking off. So that is the total of those remaining programs.
So what is EE?
Energy efficiency.
Okay, thank you. Yes,
thank you.
We'll make sure to spell that out next time. let's switch to capital programs. So since we have a large capital expenditure, we break it into programs, which just makes it kind of easier to group and do historical analysis. And so we're highlighting some of the major programs that we have. First on the left is our capital asset program. And this is basically the continuous improvement of our replacing our equipment. We have a couple pole replacements belong in here. This year, the Cat Island cable replacement is in here, about $67 million in 2026. Our expansion program is basically we're taking our existing infrastructure and adding capacity. We've got the major additions to our system. So Camino Substation is an example of one of those in the 2026 budget. And our upgrade program, I'm sorry, expansion program is brand new. I apologize. Upgrade program is when we're upgrading our existing facilities.
And how often do we replace old equipment? I mean, an average, like maybe every other year, every year, I don't know.
That's a great question. Okay. It really depends. Poles would be on an average life of 30 years-ish. Major substation equipment is 30 to 50 years. But again, you think about, we just celebrated our anniversary. We are now in the process of having to replace a lot of that infrastructure and or upgrade it to, serve more customers or enhance reliability.
For this amount, the $67.2 million we allocated specifically for that capital asset program. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
I can speak from personal experience of when we first moved into that same house almost entire time we lived in Washington. The substation, our power was highly unreliable. Very, very, very reliable. I had to have a battery backup to do any work and I had underground power. But then the Eagle Creek substation, which is my substation, used to be your substation on your bill, got upgraded and bought a generator at some point. It took me 5 years before I got to use it for the first time. The reliability of the substations is pretty phenomenal, basically.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, and Sarah knows this stuff better than I do, but I think average depreciation on most distribution assets is in the 30-year time frame. So that's kind of what you expect your capital assets to last.
Thank you. Another part of our capital programs, all of the transportation equipment that we do to provide support to all of our programs. So this is basically replacing, worn out vehicles or upgrading existing vehicles and equipment too. Our customer and reimbursable work. So this is work that we do on behalf of our customers. It's our overhead and underground services, reimbursable, large customer requests, et cetera. The vast majority of this work is reimbursed. And a facilities capital, we're not in the middle of a local office at the moment, so it's a smaller number than we've been seeing for a while, but still some continuous work. We mentioned a little bit earlier, I think, about upgrading some HVACs and some work being done to keep our buildings up to speed. Last but not least, some of our major programs. We've got our Connect Up program. We'll be in the almost final year in 2026 to finish putting the meters in. We are funding the majority of this program with bond proceeds. Snow Smart, which you've been briefed on as well, we've got about $14 million in expenditures, and we are expecting reimbursement from partial reimbursement from a DOE grant. And then today you were briefed on the Two to the Cloud S4 project, so the capital project that is a third of upgrade our current SAP platform. So those are some of the major capital programs that we have in the budget in 2026.
Commissioner Logan, this is Commissioner Olson. On slide 16, there's no number with transportation and equipment. There's no dollar. Oh, I see. It's on this one. All right. No question. Sorry to interrupt.
No worries.
The version I have doesn't have any dollars on it.
Oh, interesting. So let's take all the pieces, tie all the pieces together. So this is our current 5-year forecast. A lot of numbers on here. I understand. I'll walk through some of the assumptions. We'll start with our energy retail sales. You saw the load forecast from Felician earlier today. It is relatively flat. There's a little bit of growth in there, but there isn't substantial growth within the years that we're looking at here. We've already spent quite a bit of time talking about our proposed general rate increases from starting in 2025. So you'll see the growth in our energy retail sales due to those two factors. Energy wholesale sales, you're going to see the numbers decreasing and eventually go to zero. So of course, again, removing from the being on the wholesale market and selling our excess power to the term sales so that we're selling, we're marketing some of our contracts, but eventually those are all going away. So that will no longer be a revenue stream. And other operating revenues, there's a variety of things in there. We expect them to stay pretty flat. Purchase power. A lot of show you all, there's a lot of different components in purchase power. There's a lot of puts and takes. You can see if you look from the 2025 to 2026, you'll see the drop that is due to the load following switch. And we maintain that drop until 29 and 2030. We're assuming that we will be moving to tier two EPA power in those years at the moment. At the same time, our wind contracts will be starting to expire and they'll be completely gone by the end of 2030. And then generation, there's some big projects out in the future years that are going to push up those costs a little bit as well. So lots of puts and takes in our purchase power assumptions. Operations and maintenance. Also, again, there's quite a bit that goes into those numbers. Some of the biggest items is we are still expecting inflation on many costs. There's going to be some fluctuations in years where we have larger capital projects. We're able to expense more of our costs, so it brings down our O&M. And then we have some labor. The numbers that you saw earlier from Christine Doris, the labor, it shifts costs between O&M and capital a little bit. So you'll see some shifts there. But for the most part, we're expecting some steady increases in O&M. Capital expenditures. We have a pretty robust capital program. It has our most recent forecast from the departments. We are assuming $175 million bond funding in 2028, which will help pay for some of those expenditures. Down at the bottom, we've talked about the day's cash on hand. This was part of the discussions that we've had prior on our rates. And so this is where we landed. We are expecting to be at our minimums with this budget in the forecast. Last but not least, we like to disclose where we expect our reserve levels to be at the end of the next budget year. This first slide are the unrestricted reserves, the ones that make up our days cash on hand calculation. You can see we're expecting to use just the tiniest bit of our operating reserve because we're using bond funds to pay for a lot of our capital. Contingency reserve and sinking funds won't change substantially. And just a quick disclosure on our unrestricted reserves. These are ones that we have to use for a specific purpose. The one that I think is probably the most interesting is our project reserves. This is our construction funds. So we've issued dollars in 2025, and we've been spending them down. So this is just the planned use of those reserves in 2026. And I won't go through the others. And that is what we have today. We'll be coming back to the next public hearing. We'll be talking about budget for water. November 18th, we'll be talking about any changes or proposal, any proposed changes we may have, and then December 2nd.
Any more questions for Sarah? Thanks, Sarah. Very good presentation. Thank you. Are there any comments from the public regarding the proposed budget? Please raise your hand. See any hands up in the room or online? Commissioners, I already asked you, do you have more questions, I assume? I will call for a motion to continue the public hearing on the 2026 proposed budget.
I move the public hearing on the 2026 proposed budget by continuing to Tuesday, November 4, 2025 at 9 a.m. at 2320 California Street in Everett.
I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Motion passed unanimously. Next, item six, public hearing action. 6A, consideration of resolution amending the district's water retail rates and charge to pass through City of Everett purchase water cost increase. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Now for the public hearing, we have Christina Hart available to answer any questions and provide the prior presentation if necessary. I'll ask if there's any questions from the public, please raise your hand. Any online or in the room? Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have none.
None, we've been briefed on this.
Yes, thoroughly, thank you. Okay, then I will close the public hearing and I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay. Aye. Aye. Did you say aye, Commissioner Olson?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Motion passed unanimously. Next, item seven, items for individual consideration. 7A, consideration of a resolution authorizing the CEO general manager or his designee to execute amendment one to the wholesale water agreement between Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County and City of Snohomish. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Hey, Christina is still available here to answer any questions. Are there any comments from the public regarding this resolution? Please raise your hand. And no hands raised. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I think that we receive all the information.
Okay. Hearing none, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed unanimously. Next is item eight, commission business. 8A, commission reports. Are there any reports, commissioners? Commissioner Olson, do you have any reports? Yeah, I think that is no. Next, we'll move to 8B, our Commission Event Calendar. This is on page 166 of our packet. Are there any changes to the event calendar? Still not responded to November PPC and PNUC, but I think I'm going to be annoyed. I know I owe you a response.
A meeting for cancellation, I think, for the state of the station, right?
There is. Mine's not loading. October 22nd.
Yeah. Thank you for catching that. Anything else, commissioners?
I thought that the state of the station was moved. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what Commissioner.
All right. Thank you.
Yes,
thank-
Donnie, I'm so happy to say that in Spanish as well.
Was that directed at me?
No.
You're going to have a long wait, my dear.
Okay. Next is agenda item nine, our governance planning calendar. Any changes to the governance planning calendar? This begins on page 170 of the packet.
I hate to, this, Commissioner Olson. I hate to ask this, but because this calendar is a working calendar, is there any chance, I guess I'm asking the clerk of the board, that the moved to date could be in a different color other than red?
Sure. Do you have a preference?
I don't care what, I don't know why, but I keep skipping over the movement thing and then I have to go back. So if it isn't a lot of trouble,
no,
let the president decide if he wants what color he wants. I don't care.
Maybe a different color, maybe we should bold it.
Do you mean everything or just the move to date?
I think the things that are in red.
I only want the move to date.
Okay.
In a different
the actual
color.
Item can remain in red.
Okay, we'll work on it.
Okay.
Okay. So now it is now 11:25, and the board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. We anticipated the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes, so we give ourselves 4 minutes to get started on it. Will conclude right at 12 noon. The regular meeting will adjourn upon the conclusion of the executive session. It is now 11:54, and we have returned from the executive session, and our meeting is over.